Good Thursday. This is Ozarks at Large for September 24th, 2020, and this is your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead this hour, firefighters from Fort Smith left last week to help battle wildfires in the western states. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek will tell us more. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting a combined 982 confirmed and likely new cases of COVID-19 in the past 24-hour testing period, with 20 additional deaths. There have now been a total of 1,229 confirmed and likely COVID-19 deaths in the state. Nearly 73% of those deaths have occurred in Arkansans 65 and older. Last night's Northwest Arkansas Healthcare Community Report lists 64 new cases diagnosed in Benton County, 75 in Washington County, and there are 46 patients in COVID-19 units in the two counties' hospitals. That represents no change in number over the past 24 hours. Some area high school football games scheduled for this weekend and later are being canceled because of COVID-19 quarantines. The game between Fayetteville High School and Bentonville West High School in Fayetteville will not take place. Rogers High School's varsity and junior varsity teams have canceled games on September 25th and 28th and October 2nd and 5th. The Rogers freshman team not affected and will play games as scheduled. And the Friday night game between Farmington and Harrison canceled, though Harrison and Ozark will now play on Friday night because Ozark's original opponent for the week, Dardanelle, cannot play because of quarantine regulations. The Northwest Arkansas Council will host a voter participation forum tomorrow. The digital event is designed for business and community leaders to learn about some of the corporate and small business efforts and strategies designed to increase voter participation in the fall election. The forum is from 1:30 to 2:30 tomorrow and will be moderated by Randy Wilburn, founder and host of the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. The session is open to the public and free, advance registration required. You can find a link for registration by going to the news tab at nwacouncil.org. This is Ozarks at Large. The number of farmers in the United States continues to shrink. Have you ever wondered what it really takes to become a farmer? A new certificate program from the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture is training a new generation of aspiring farmers in an effort to reinvigorate local foodways. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports.
For decades, the business of farming in the U.S. has been on the decline. Data from the U.S. Census Bureau from 2017 shows that the number of small farms in the country dropped from 7 million to nearly 2 million in just 50 years, with the average age of the American farmer being just shy of 60 years old. Now, Arkansas is trying to engage with new would-be farmers through apprenticeship and training programs like the University of Arkansas Extension Service's new Farm School, which welcomes its inaugural class this January. Heather Frederick, Assistant Director for the Center for Farms and Food with the Division of Agriculture, says this latest effort is an important step in re-energizing an ailing industry.
The Farm School is a really good entry point for people who don't have any experience in farming, but, you know, they're interested in it as a profession, you know, because we really take you through the basics of, you know, production of specialty crops on two different scales, and we also do a lot with business development and entrepreneurial skills and legal issues as well. It's a more comprehensive program.
Last year, the Extension Service launched an apprenticeship program that placed aspiring farmers with local producers throughout Arkansas.
It's a little bit different than the Farm School. We do have a series of 12 classes that is associated with the apprenticeship program, and they range from production, business, and legal as well. But really, you know, because those classes are, you know, they're only like 2.5 hours long. We can't go as deep on the kind of theoretical knowledge for those topics. So the real meat of the learning happens alongside that farmer. And so we really need to balance farmers' skills and their expertise with the interest of the apprentice. you know, maybe gaining, you know, kind of a special experience in maybe marketing or maybe it's, you know, flower production. And so we match those, that interest up with the farmers that can provide that kind of experience. You know, the apprentices are assessed every 2 months on a series of skills. And so we want to see increasing levels of independence across those different skills. And they're, you know, pretty comprehensive in scope. It covers, you know, production, like, you know, reading field maps and taking soil samples and getting a little bit into crop planning, but also, you know, the financial aspects of like record keeping, you know, invoicing, marketing, and those different kinds of entrepreneurial skills.
That intensive program lasts anywhere from 10 months to 2 years and includes housing and a monthly stipend or wage that is set by each individual farm. Frederick says the farm school is a more accessible option for people who are thinking about farming as a possible career. The 11-month program, which takes place in Fayetteville, is 20 hours a week and costs $2,000 per person.
And so anybody over the age of 18 is eligible to enroll. You know, some of the, like a preview of the some of the candidates, you know, they're from not just Arkansas, but around the state and even in neighboring states. Some of them have, you know, a strong background in agriculture, and others, this is a really a new career path for them. And so they're coming from vastly different backgrounds, because we are nearing the end of our first year in the apprenticeship program. The candidates from that program, similarly, they come from a pretty wide background. Some of them were completely new to farming. So, you know, especially farming within the context of local food systems. A couple of them did have that strong kind of training in that scientific background in agriculture. So, you know, we're really getting a wide variety of people and skills.
And variety, she says, is vital to making agriculture more attractive to a new crop of farmers. Statistics from the U.S. Census Bureau show that in 2017, nearly 96% of farmers were white, with women making up only 30% of total farm producers.
You know, when we do think of farmers, it's typically that white male and older also. And so, you know, special crop farming that's really marketing towards local and regional food systems, the entry point for that is definitely different than large scale, you know, commodity crop production. It's easier, you know, it doesn't take as much resources to get into, like, you know, grow food for, like, say, the farmer's market. It does take the skills, though, you know, so we do want to represent a diverse field. We want to represent diversity within our cohorts. And that's something that we will be considering.
Frederick says besides working to change the face of farming in the state, the farm school is looking to fill a gap in local food systems, which are vastly underrepresented across industries in Arkansas.
We have a really strong network of farmers markets, but we really want to see growth in that kind of next level of local food systems, getting local foods into more schools, more institutions, hospitals, food service operations, more restaurants and grocers. Our role is really focusing on the farmer development. And also one of the other important aspects is networking. Having a strong farm community is really important to us. And so we look forward to, you know, hopefully after this COVID situation goes away, we can have some farmer networking events where we can strengthen our local farm community, but also open up some doors for some farmer market buyer kind of networking events as well.
And like so much else in 2020, the coronavirus also looms large over the farm school, which moved from 15 eligible spots to only 8 to accommodate class size. And Frederick says both the school and apprenticeship programs have had to make changes because of the pandemic.
You know, everybody has to wear a face mask inside. When we're working outside, if we're working together in a group, we'll still be required to wear the face mask. But if you're working kind of, you know, definitely away from other people, because there'll be some independent work, you won't have to wear a face mask. interestingly, with our apprenticeship program, you know, when COVID hit, just right after most of our apprentices had started their on-farm experience. So that was an interesting situation. And they all adapted really well. And I think it was a really good learning experience for them because they could see what farmers face when dealing with, in this case, it was a pandemic, but, you know, natural disasters and, you know, how adaptable as a farmer was, I think, really a really good learning experience for those apprentices.
And that adaptability is what the farm school and apprenticeship programs are all about. Frederick says this program will give students the tools they need to understand the realities of modern farming.
You know, a lot of people have a lot of romantic ideas about, you know, what farming is. And, you know, it's one thing to grow a crop, but it's another thing to be able to plan, you know, your harvest and, you know, when you need your crops for sale and, you know, it's a completely different thing to be able to make your, you know, income off of farming. And so, yeah, there's, you know, definitely a learning curve and, you know, some bursting of bubbles when it comes to the programs, but that's to be expected.
Applications for the farm school are open now through October 31st and for the apprenticeship program through November 15th on the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture website. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Just ahead on this Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large, Zuzanna Sitek talks with Wesley McKinney, a Conway County Ranger for the Arkansas Department of Agriculture's Forestry Division. He has just returned from California, where he was helping fight fires. Right now, I'm Kyle Kellums, and I'd like to remind you that this is the penultimate day for the on-air fundraiser for KUAF this fall. We are in the midst of a fundraising month. At the end of this month, we would like to have raised $140,000. We know that's what we need to raise to continue to bring you the programs like Ozarks at Large that bring you the news from your hometown, your region, your state, plus bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, The Pick and Post, Jazz Scoop, and all of the programs that you enjoy on this radio station. We are a nonprofit business, but we're still a business. The bills have not gone away in 2020. If you're able and you can make a contribution, I encourage you to do so. You get to pick the amount. Just go to supportkuaf.com. Kurt Stamp of Fayetteville has issued another Ozarks at Large specific challenge this afternoon, $250. If we can all work together, raise $250 among ourselves, Kurt Stamp will match that. Means we've raised $500 during Ozarks at Large for this Thursday. Every contribution made during this Thursday afternoon Ozarks at Large counts toward that challenge of $250. Love to meet it right now if we could. SupportKUAF.com. It takes a couple of minutes. We do not have phone volunteers during the pandemic. The Carver Center for Public Radio remains closed to anyone who is not on the full-time staff. So no phone volunteers, no phones. Just the web, supportkuaf.com. It is safe, it is secure, it is fast and efficient. You can go to supportkuaf.com. All contributions, be they new, be they gift subscriptions, be they renewal memberships, they all count towards this challenge from our great friend Kurt Stamp. It's a $250 challenge today. Help us meet that at supportkuaf.com, and thank you.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Arcega's drive-thru location at 1509 MLK in Fayetteville. Open 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. with a full coffee menu, espresso options, seasonal drinks, and a small foods menu. Arcega's.com or Facebook for more. Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens, offering mini and large pumpkins, ornamental squash and corn stalks, as well as mums for fall decorating. WestwoodGardens.com for more information or to place a pickup order.
This is Ozarks at Large. As dozens of wildfires continue to burn across the western United States, Arkansas firefighters have been called in to assist containment efforts. Last week, a team of 20 firefighters known as the Razorback Crew left Fort Smith for Oregon. Meanwhile, Wesley McKinney, a Conway County Ranger for the Arkansas Department of Agriculture's Forestry Division, returned earlier this month from California, where he worked on the August Complex Fire, which has burned nearly 900,000 acres of land so far, making it the largest fire in the state's history. The fire started on August 17th, and at this point, it's about 40% contained. McKinney spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek about his deployment.
What did your role look like out there while assisting on that fire?
So I went out as a division supervisor. So I managed crews and all that, engines on the division of the fire. The Razorback crew that's out is a 20-man crew that's in Oregon on the Thelson fire. And they are doing hand line construction, taking the fire lines down the mineral soil, prepping it with hoses so they can start mopping up any hot spots on that line to keep it contained in there, and then doing any strategic firing operation to stay ahead of the fire.
Can you explain to us how these deployments to assist in other parts of the country work?
So we all do the same training across the nation. The good thing is when the West is burning, that they can allocate resources from the Southeast area, the East area. And so we put this crew together, and it comprises of U.S. Forest Service, Forestry Division, National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife. And it's a crew that when we're not burning in Arkansas, we can put them together and send them out west to assist them, because they don't have enough resources out west, especially right now with the how many fires are going and the large fires that are going.
How many times have you gone out west to provide this kind of assistance?
I've been doing it since 2011. I guess you could say I've been going out and assisting out west. The Razorback crew, they started in 2013. So this would be their seventh year going out west to assist in any state that's needing the help.
A lot of us have seen the photos from out west from these fires, and we've seen videos. But having been on the ground, what is that experience like?
It's challenging. So when you leave from here to Arkansas to, California, you get into steeper terrain that's in there, a different fuel type as far as like chaparral, manzita. You still got the pines out there. Pines burn pretty much the same here as they do out there, but they're just in a drought too for right now. And then we'd have days where we didn't see the sun for, 48 hours. We'd fight fire, but we'd be socked in there. And we use technologies such as IR flights to see where that fire edge is so we can make sure we put our crews and stuff in there safely.
And having done this since 2011, do you see a difference in these fires now versus what they looked like almost 10 years ago?
Well, that's a hard to say, because I've been on record fires in Washington that burned extremely hot back in, 2014 in there. California and Oregon right now are seeing record number acres, and it's because they're in a drought and weather patterns lined up, and they had a ton of lightning in there that caused a lot of these fires. It's not that it's different behavior. It's what we've got accustomed to, that we're seeing larger fires on the landscape. And this year is challenging because you throw in the COVID-19, and some people aren't wanting to travel because of the spread of COVID-19, and some resources didn't get filled this year. So that was some of the problems we were running into, is the resources were, some of them weren't there just because, the risk factor.
So how did those COVID-19 protocols work while you're out there trying to extinguish these fires?
Well, so it's, we're used to large incident command posts, or camps is what we call them. Where that's where we sleep, eat, we come in from the line, that's where we meet. Well, this year, we come in, we check into those camps, but we right away get sent to our piece of line that we're going to work, what we call divisions. And we stay within that division, sleep. They bring our food to us to keep us from getting into the communities or having to travel through there to risk the spray. We don't want to catch, just like any community, we don't want to catch it, because that's going to take that resource away if somebody tests positive for the COVID-19. But it's a challenge. Logistically, it's a challenge for these teams to support us on these divisions, because it's so scattered out. So you might have 10 divisions on a fire, and they're having to support that in 10 different locations.
So it's already hot because it's summer in California. there are fires burning nearby, and you have all your gear. What is that like for firefighters?
Well, you get accustomed to it because that's our protection. That's our Nomex that's in there. And then we carry, 45 pounds or so gear, including our fire shelter and stuff. But you get accustomed with working with it, and some of the things we utilize this year that we were closer to the line with these camps is we would go in, do our work early while it was cooler, and then held on to what we had during the heat of the day. Then towards later in the evening, we'd go back and do a little bit more progress in there to keep our crews, rested and keep them focused on what we're doing, because we don't want to see injuries. Our number one thing is public firefighter safety. So we got to keep a close eye on that, on overworking them and making sure we're not risking their lives or their safety on that line.
How important is the weather to helping you all put out these fires?
Oh, weather is a huge factor, so there's certain days, if it's hot, windy, we might not be able to get on that line because the fire's making a big run in there. But if we could get humidity mixed in there with maybe some cloud cover, less winds, then it's more proactive for our ground forces to get in there and start putting secure lines around the fire. So weather plays a huge factor in what we do, and it drives kind of our decision making on engaging it or disengaging it.
This next question, I'm not sure how much you can discuss given your role, but since you've been out west and worked on these fires for so many years, do you think about how climate change factors into what's happening?
Yeah, we read the stuff, we read the science in there, and yeah, we think about it, but I'm not going to dig into where my stance or our agency stance is on that one.
Why is it that California is burning as much as it is and Arkansas isn't?
It's the climate. When you look at, their drier climate, lower humidity, get hotter in there, and so all that creates a fire environment that's in there. And that's the one we always see, early May in there, you'll see fires progress from the southwest, and then it'll work its way up to the northwest as, you get into August and September. And of course, you'll watch Southern Cal will go to their peak fire season in next month when they have the Santa Ana winds that come off the Mojave Desert in there. So it's not that it's a, something that we're never going to deal with. We'll always deal with the wildfires out west, and we'll deal with them here too. We just fortunate enough to have recovery, and we have a lot more abundant rain that's here. But we'll have our season. 2012 was the last one that a lot of people remember. We'll deal with that again. And in between that, we got a lot of fuel that's growing. So when we get dry in the summer and the fall, we're going to deal with the same thing here.
Are you expecting to head out west again this season?
So once the Razorback crew gets back, then I'll look at it to see if they still need resources out there. Right now, I'm staying in state in case, any fire danger pops up that we have coverage in here. So, yeah, when they get back, I'll look at it. Right now, I'm just, I check in with them, try to daily to make sure they're doing okay and see if there's any needs that they need.
And is there something about wildfires or the work that you do that maybe people don't understand, or they think it's one way, but it's actually not that way at all? Anything you'd like to maybe clarify for our listeners?
Well, it's I think the clarification is we do our best with what we have. Ultimately, our number one goal is public safety, firefighter safety. Houses can be replaced, firefighters can't. So we do the best we can to protect the infrastructure that's in there. But, a lot of people think that we should be given more in there. But, we got certain thresholds that we have to pull our folks out for safety. And I would say, have prayers for the Razorback crew and other people that are in Arkansas that are out there. It's not just the Razorback crew. There's a lot of folks that are actually out there that are helping with this, and just keep them in your thoughts and prayers until we get them home safely in the next couple of weeks. And just know that Arkansas is covered, even with them gone. That we start fires here, we still got people to respond and take care of the state.
Thank you so much for your time and all those insights into what it's like to fight a wildfire.
No, I appreciate it, and I appreciate you telling our story.
That was Wesley McKinney, a Conway County Ranger for the Arkansas Department of Agriculture's Forestry Division, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek about his deployment to Northern California, where he assisted with containment efforts on the August Complex Fire. And this is a Thursday afternoon edition of Ozarks at Large, still to come on our show this afternoon. This week's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report includes a conversation with Sarah Huckabee Sanders about her new book, and Leah Uribe in Sound Perimeter examines lullabies, something that sounds really good at this point in 2020. That's all to come in our second half of the show. This reminder, before we get there, though, this is the on-air fundraising portion of September 2020 for 91.3 KUAF. We are asking you to continue your relationship, or perhaps for the first time ever, invest in your relationship with your public radio station. Listener support is the biggest part of our budget. Simply put, this is no exaggeration, we wouldn't be here without listener contributions. Morning Edition wouldn't be here on 91.3. Ozarks at Large wouldn't be here. Jazz, Peter Vandegraaff and Classical Music Tonight, you name it, it wouldn't be here. For 35 years, this has worked just fine. We think it will continue to do so. It has been a rough year. Not everyone can contribute or perhaps contribute what they'd like. We get that. We understand that. Just let you know that for us to continue to bring you the programs and services we bring you without interruption, we know that we have to raise $140,000 through September. It's not all on you. We all work together. If you can make a contribution and you get to determine how much that contribution is, I ask you to go to supportkuaf.com right now. And as a special bonus, if you can give up to $250 right now, Kurt Stamp, our great friend of Fayetteville, who has made challenges during the first three afternoons of Ozarks at Large this week, has a $250 challenge that we'd like to meet during this hour of Ozarks at Large. All contributions made during this hour count toward that challenge. SupportKUAF.com, doing your part in whatever amount to make sure the public radio and Ozarks at Large remain here for you. SupportKUAF.com. If you do give during Ozarks at Large, you're automatically entered to win the 8 books from Raven Cook's reading list that she discussed this summer in her Reflections in Black segments. Those books already ready for our winner at the Dixon Street Bookshop in Fayetteville. We'll pick the winner tomorrow on our noon edition of Ozarks at Large. If you have already given or you'd like to enter the contest without contributing, send an email to member@kuaf.com. All contributions this hour automatically entered. All contributions this hour go toward that Kurt Stamp $250 challenge. You determine the amount of your contribution. We'd love to read from you at supportkuaf.com. From all your fellow listeners who've already given, thank you very much.
Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. What must it be like to work behind the scenes in the Trump White House? Former press secretary and native Arkansan Sarah Huckabee Sanders has a new book out with her version of events. She spoke recently with Roby Brock, and we're going to play some of that conversation for you on today's program. Plus, we'll take a look at some of the latest commercial real estate transactions in the region. You'll find the full rundown in Real Deals. It's a regular feature in each issue of the Business Journal, and you can find it online now at nwabusinessjournal.com. After the break, we will hear from former White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So keep it right here on the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders' new book, Speaking for Myself, offers her version of events behind the scenes during her tenure in the Trump White House. Serving in the press office and as White House press secretary for 2.5 years, Huckabee Sanders said she felt the time was right to write the book now in order to counterbalance other narratives that paint a darker picture of President Trump and his time in office. Huckabee Sanders was a guest recently on Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock. FYI, there was a tape delay in the satellite interview that neither Brock nor Huckabee Sanders could hear, and it makes it sound as if Brock is interrupting Huckabee Sanders. I assure you that was not the case, so please excuse the technical gaffe.
Why did you feel the need to write this book at this particular juncture? You could have waited till Donald Trump wasn't in office, whether that's after November or 4 years from now, but why did you feel the need to write this book now?
Well, I think there have been so many negative books about the president, and oftentimes from people who didn't spend the type of time with him that I did. I saw a president who loves this country, is fighting for America, and I saw the generous and compassionate side of Donald Trump day in and day out over the 2.5 years that I spent working for him. And I wanted people to see the person that I got to know. And that was one of the big catalysts for writing the book. And I hope people will read it and enjoy laughing a little, crying a little, and maybe even be inspired a little to fight for what matters in this country.
This will not be news to you, but there have been some critics who have questioned your credibility because of your time at the White House podium there. In particular, they've cited the James Comey firing and your statements on that. There's been the Jim Acosta video that was just doctored somewhat. I want you to address your critics and tell me, why should your account of what happened in this book be considered credible?
Well, I address a lot of that in the book head on. And if anybody, I think, has a credibility problem in this country, it's the media and Democrats who spent 2.5 years attacking the president, maliciously attacking him and pushing a false narrative that somehow he colluded with Russia. Not only did they say that, they called him a traitor to his own country. The lies and the attacks that came after this president were outrageous, but they didn't stop just with him. They went after everybody in his administration. We fought hard, and I'm proud of the record of accomplishment under this president. I'm proud of my time in the White House, and I loved the work that I did. And I encourage people to read my side of the story in the book, Speaking for Myself.
All right. I want to get a little bit into some presidential psychology here, since you have such a great perspective on this. You write about it in the book some. I'm curious for some more detail. How does a prep meeting with the president go when you were White House press secretary? You know what some of the questions are going to be. It's fairly predictable. But at the same time, you've got a president that has a proclivity to tweet on a moment's notice. And then, of course, you know how he thinks. So how did you prep for those White House press briefings and for putting statements together on behalf of the president?
Well, certainly, I think one of the best preparation is getting to know the principal that you're speaking on behalf of. I was fortunate enough that I got to spend a lot of time with the president, and I wasn't just trying to learn things prior to walking into the room, but I had a very good foundation. I was in the room for those critical decisions and those critical moments, so I watched things as they were happening, and I participated in those meetings. So I wasn't just trying to put it together right before walking in the door. One of the things that this president, he may be fighting with the press a lot, but he understood the power of the press and knew it would be impossible for me to do my job effectively if I didn't know the message. And the best way to do that was to have me in the room. And so he took me with him everywhere. I participated in every foreign trip that he took, sitting at the table with world leaders, dozens and dozens of world leaders, and watching those moments and participating in that helped prep me. The other part is, like you said, you know a lot of the questions that are coming, so you try to prepare for those as best you can. But there are so many things. Everything is on the table, so you try to be as up to speed on as many different topics as possible. Sometimes we got it right. Sometimes we got some wild cards, and we had to go with our gut instinct on our response, or would have to get back to that reporter at a later time instead of addressing it directly in the briefing.
You loved the job of White House press secretary. I know it took a toll on you and your family, but why did you leave the most important job you've ever held?
Well, in large part, after 2.5 years, I had spent that time in the White House missing some critical moments for my kids, which I talk about extensively throughout the book. In part, I had to change my kids' birthday. We celebrated on a different day than their actual birthday. A lot of people can be the White House press secretary. Only one person could be mom to my kids, and it was time for me to take a step back so I could really spend a lot more time with my family. I've loved having that time being back here in Arkansas, a little bit away from some of the critics, and getting to spend that time with my kids.
You've worked for a number of politicians. Your father being one. You've worked on his presidential campaign. Senator John Bozeman is another one there. I kind of put both of them in the category of consensus builders. You see them over the course of their public life have built a lot of consensus. President Trump obviously has the reputation for being more divisive. I don't see the same kind of rhetoric that comes from a Donald Trump that you might see from your father or from a John Bozeman. Why does the president not have more of your father and John Bozeman in his politics, in your estimation, with you being as close to all three of them as you are?
Well, I think the president is very much his own person. I think one of the reasons he won in 2016 and one of the reasons he's been able to get so much done over these past 4 years is because he went in and he shook up Washington. He did things in a way that they had never been done before. People were looking for a change agent, a disruptor, and they certainly got that in Donald Trump.
And that is Sarah Huckabee Sanders. You can watch the full interview at talkbusiness.net. She is, of course, the daughter of former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. And she's been asked hundreds of times about her own run for governor in 2022. True to form, she says a decision on a possible campaign will not be made until well after the November elections. A Missouri real estate developer broke ground recently on a $16 million multifamily development in Rogers. TLC Properties is the developer behind Promenade Commons. It's a 144,000 square foot, 131 unit property for tenants 55 and older. Construction is scheduled to be completed next spring. And a North Carolina investor paid $19.9 million for three self-storage facilities in Benton and Washington counties. Signature Bank of Arkansas financed all three deals. For a complete rundown of important real estate transactions in Northwest Arkansas, check out the Real Deals section in each issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. You can find the digital version at nwabusinessjournal.com. And that is all for today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Leah Uribe and Sound Perimeter, exploring lullabies just ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. A reminder that during this on-air fundraiser week, if you give during Ozarks at Large, you could win the entire list of books recommended by Raven Cook, host of Reflections in Black. She gave these reading recommendations during summer editions of Ozarks at Large. Our partner in this endeavor, the Dixon Street Bookstore, they have the entire list of Raven's picks for learning more about Black History in America, waiting for the winner at their location in Fayetteville. The titles include The Origin of Others from Toni Morrison, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, and The Souls of Black Folk from W.E.B. Du Bois. If you've already supported the station this month or would like to enter the giveaway without giving, you can send an email to member@kuaf.com to be entered. We'll draw for a winner of the Raven's Reading List books during our noon show tomorrow. You can support Reflections in Black and all your favorite moments on Ozarks at Large by giving a gift right now at supportkuaf.com, and thank you.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. Lullaby refers specifically to a song used to calm down children or put them to sleep. Lullabies are often short, repetitive, basic, and some of them a little sad. That sadness that in music we recognize as sublime. Who doesn't need a lullaby these days? Our opening excerpt, Johannes Brahms' Vegan Lied, Opus 49, Number 4, is perhaps the most well-known lullaby of all times. Recently, I came across Gideon's Lullaby, a track from my friend Amos Cochrane's latest album, Niente. Amos Cochrane is an Emmy-nominated, locally-based composer, musician, and sound artist. He released Niente a few weeks ago, featuring Miranda Baker in the violin, Christian Serrano Torres in the cello, and himself in the piano. Gideon's Lullaby was originally conceived in 2017 as part of a musical score Cochrane wrote for a high school theater company play. During that time, one of the students participating in the play died. For this album, Amos took the melody from the play's original score, arranged it for piano, violin, and cello, and dedicated the piece to the student's memory by titling it Gideon's Lullaby. In Cochrane's words, "I believe it represents the idea that living is the most fragile thing, and the fine line between beauty and tragedy, happiness and sorrow, is what makes it such a journey. Always remembering to end to an optimistic note." Let's hold to that fine line, to the optimism, and listen to a passage of Gideon's Lullaby. Miranda Baker, violin, Christian Serrano Gomez, cello, and Amos Cochrane, piano, performing Gideon's Lullaby from Cochrane's latest album, Niente. One of my favorite tunes of all time is Chucho Valdés' Berceuse à Jesse. Berceuse is French for lullaby. Chucho Valdés is a Cuban pianist, composer, band leader, and arranger. I grew up listening to his music and saw him in live concerts with his band, Iraquere, while I was still living in my native country, Colombia. When my kids were born in the early 2000s, I came across the album Cuban Lullaby, a compilation of songs and tunes that very much took me to my childhood and helped me connect my own kids with my own traditions. That's how I found Berceuse à Jesse, which I want to share with you today, its simplicity and beauty and the sense of hope for calmness. Let's listen to Chucho Valdés' Berceuse à Jesse from the early 2000s album Cuban Lullaby. Thank you. That was Grammy winner Chucho Valdez, Cuban pianist and leader and composer, interpreting Versus e Jesse. This is Leah Uribe, associate professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Eureka Springs. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors included Daniel Carruth, Zuzana Sitek, and Leah Uribe. Our show produced by Timothy Dennis, Sound Perimeter produced by Lee Wood. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling and Roby Brock is part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find out more about Daryl at his Facebook and Instagram feeds. Thanks so much to Kurt Stamp for his afternoon challenges during this fundraising week. We do appreciate it. If you have not contributed yet and you mean to do so, you can right now at supportkuaf.com. You determine the amount. It's simple, fast, and efficient. Supportkuaf.com. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Please take care of yourself. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again soon.